Oh, that's good coffee.
This is The Impromptu, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. And now, your hosts for today, Michael Norton and Alex Knight.
They've made a lot of progress in certain areas, like auto layout. There's now this new UI stack view, and the things they're doing with size classes to allow for iPad multitasking is just really cool. Then, of course, you've got Swift 2. Basically, Swift has become a mature programming language at this point.
Yeah. Didn't take too long.
No. And
open sourcing. Just read my mind. I was going to say, the open sourcing of it, I don't know. I know a lot of people got excited about it, but let's just be practical for a moment. What does that mean to you?
Well, for example, because they're releasing the compiler and they're adding Linux support, this means that you can use Swift to write server code. And Swift is extremely robust. Swift 2 has an incredible error handling system. So you can... It's basically a next generation Java with... It really has the best parts of every language. Like, it's a little bit Haskell, it's a little bit Java, it's a little bit JavaScript. It just kind of takes what works, drops what doesn't, and it provides a really clean, really efficient means of developing anything. The only thing the error handling is a bit strict, so the one thing that isn't that clear is asynchronous things. So if you are using it to write some kind of web server, then it may not be able to handle asynchronous web calls as well as it should, just because the error handling is more based on, like, you try to do something and then it fails.
Talk to me more about the server-side capability. So what does that mean? Like, does that mean I write a web-based application in Swift?
No, it would mean that you write the backend stack in Swift. So it would take the place of something like Node.js or Apache. So it would be able to serve content. You would be able to use it to write APIs. So web apps can call the Swift server, and it would be able to reply with stuff. And generally, I mean, this hasn't been built. Nobody has attempted to build this, but I would imagine that the compiled benchmarks would probably be much faster than existing tech. Swift is like 2.5 times faster than Objective-C after it's been compiled. Like, the LLVM is optimized for Swift, and Swift 2 is even faster, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's all good and everything, and I guess that's just another big reason to move your projects to Swift and start converting stuff and of course, obviously, writing new apps in Swift, because Apple clearly wants you to be using that. That is the future. But it's interesting, you know, you were talking about the web server stuff, because I didn't really conceptualize or even look at Swift as like a replacement for Node.js, because I think, like, I compare Swift to Objective-C, and I think, okay, yeah, I can write applications for it. It's just like the cleaner, faster, simpler version of Objective-C, the next sort of evolutionary step, I guess. But I mean, it's obviously different in many ways as well, but yeah, I never really thought about the server-side component of things. Now, for someone who is, let's say, a newbie with server-side stuff, do they have they released documentation? Like, how do you get started?
That's the thing, like, there is no documentation really. But one thing that gives me hope for that, I have a theory that the reason they already have Linux support for Swift is because they've already figured it out, is because they've already done it. And why would they already have done it? Siri.
So you think they've got some internal projects that have already been done in that, although they haven't perhaps announced it.
So I think like a few weeks before WWDC, they gave a talk at a conference, and they basically explained exactly how Siri works. And they said it's running on a custom fork of Apache Mesos called Jarvis. And Apache Mesos is a cloud tech that allows you to distribute programming across a cloud of servers. In other words, something perfect for machine learning and things like Siri, where you make a request with a voice print, and then they can distribute the processing time for analyzing that request, getting data, returning it. They can parallelize that processing across 100,000 CPUs across their entire cloud network using Mesos. So I think what Jarvis really is a Swift rewrite of Apache Mesos. Hence, they needed to make Swift run on Linux. Therefore, they already have it running on Linux to be able to open source it at the end of the year. Because if they were just starting on Linux support now, it would not be ready in time for the end of the year. I mean, in theory. Obviously, it's not something that their engineers would be, like, working day and night to achieve, because Linux isn't their platform. But, yeah, I mean, that's my crazy little theory, but we don't know for sure.
Right, and the speed improvements alone, I mean, it makes sense if they've been writing stuff that, you know, handles Siri and Swift, because, obviously, that's a huge complaint for people that use Siri is it's sometimes slow and, you know, often incorrect. I don't know how much that would impact, though, the performance of Siri, because it's obviously it's not done locally on your phone, right? It's calling out to Apple servers. So, but I suppose by the time the request hits Apple servers, if the request can be processed, you know, 2x faster, that means it can be theoretically, I guess, sent back so much faster. So
yeah, I mean, a lot of the lead time for Siri is figuring out what you said. So first it has to figure out what you said, then it has to take that and run it through a heuristic algorithm that parses the context of what you're saying, so literally what you're asking for, and then at that point it decides, okay, based on this information, I'm going to make these API calls to get this data, and then I'm going to return the answer.
Well, I've never felt that that there have been any issues on my end with Siri being slow with as far as my connection is concerned, because, for example, like, oftentimes if I'm out and I'm on a very solid LTE connection, I make a request to Siri, and sometimes you see that progress thing spinning and just waiting and waiting and waiting to get a request. And sometimes it's fast and sometimes it's just sitting there. So is it my ISP or is it just Apple servers that are just congested and
it could be a little bit of both.
Or a little bit of both. But
it could also be that your request is particularly complex. I mean, some requests are obviously faster than others. Asking for the weather is faster than, say, asking for give me all nearby pizza restaurants that are highly rated. So the more complex your request is, the longer it's going to take to return a result. But even then, they can obviously optimize that over time. Because the more data they have, the more Siri can understand and the faster it can respond, because obviously it's built on a machine learning platform. So the more data it has, the better it gets.
I'm interested in talking about some of the performance stuff with El Capitan, because I haven't seen a lot of people talk about it. And it's really interesting to me because I am on a 5-year-old MacBook Pro. And I remember when I upgraded from Mavericks to Yosemite, there was a significant performance hit. Everything just seems slow, like scrolling, expose, just like transitions, animations, everything was slower. And I'm really, really optimistic that there are announcements about performance improvements across the board. And, you know, using Metal for the low level stuff, that OS X uses, like all the animation stuff, you know, transitioning that from OpenGL / OpenCL or whatever to Metal, sounds like it could make a significant improvement. Have you noticed, well, obviously I know your hardware is a lot newer than mine. You have a MacBook Air. What year is it?
It's a 2013 MacBook Air.
Okay. Did you see any noticeable improvements just in terms of like smoothness in scrolling and just like animation smoothness?
Yeah,
between, like, even the full screen animations.
Oh yeah. Full screen really is drastically improved in El Capitan. Like I've been running the whole snap view thing and darting in and out, and it just glides. There's no more lag. It just kind of does exactly what you're intending it to do. I mean, sometimes it does still kind of stutter a little bit, but a lot less than it used to.
And perhaps that'll improve over time as they,
yeah,
they,
I mean,
tweak
it,
things
this
over
is
the
beta
betas,
one,
right?
So,
right. And there's debug code and stuff like that that perhaps may slow things down too. So
yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. So for a beta one, it's very stable and fairly smooth, I would say.
Are you using 1Password on it at all? Do you know if the extension works? Because oftentimes, just using like OS X betas and stuff like that, oftentimes I find that like 1Password stuff has to be updated and breaks.
I do have it. I haven't tried using it yet.
Any core apps that you use that you find you've had any quirks with? Like I know you use Dropbox and stuff like that. Does that work okay?
Oh no, Dropbox is fine. They moved to a newer API for file system stuff. So they're protected from the changes to the file system.
You're saying Dropbox moved to,
yeah, which is funny. Like Apple usually telegraphs things that they're going to do. So I think that was last WWDC or the one before that. They were basically like, so here's this new API to handle the file system. You're going to be able to access everything and be able to extend things using this API. You should really look at using this. Wink. And so, sure enough, here we are, 1 or 2 years later, El Capitan. Oh, hey, we're locking this stuff down. You should use this API now to access the stuff that is no longer accessible. So here's Dropbox already supporting it, and it works just fine.
The one thing that I always wish that iCloud Drive would have is, you know, something that effectively copies the Dropbox sharing of files feature. Which would get me to probably, I could almost switch everything from Dropbox to iCloud Drive. I actually haven't had any issues with iCloud Drive so far. I've been using it since they announced it. I haven't lost any files. The syncing is very fast. It's been pretty good so far. But yeah, I just wish I could, you know, just share one file with somebody, and you can't do that right now.
It looks like you can now. I mean, iCloud Drive is obviously a bigger part of the overall ecosystem. It shows up as a tab in Finder, and on iOS now, it shows up as an app. So, I mean, every app has its own iCloud Drive folder, and then the files are pretty much like regular files. You can share them through mail, messages, AirDrop. Looks like you can add some share extensions as well. Can't share a direct link though. So you can send the file to someone, but you can't do the Dropbox method of here's a web link. I think down the road it might be possible to share it with someone's iCloud, though. They would have to prioritize it, though. I mean, obviously, they don't have, like, they don't, well, they might have a dedicated team for iCloud Drive, but if it was something that was going to happen, it would probably end up being next year. Though, they are seemingly moving to a more distributed release cycle. Like, the past few iOS updates, they've added, like, big features. Like, 8.4 is going to have Apple Music. 8.3 was a major bug fix release that had further Apple Watch compatibility. 8.2 added Apple Watch compatibility. And 8.1, I forget what they added there, but they added something there.
I always hoped that Apple would move to more of a Google model with what they did with Android and separating a lot of the built-in services. And so, for example, things like, things that are integral to the operating system, like a browser, for example, could get significant updates independently of an OS update. It doesn't seem like Apple's ever going to adopt that model. I can kind of see why they would not want to do that, but it sounds like this is maybe the best that we're going to get, like you're saying, these more frequent distributed like versions of iOS, where we get like an 8.4 seems like such a minor release, but like we have this, you know, completely redesigned music that you would think would have been reserved for something like iOS 9, but we're getting it early.
Yeah, exactly. I think we're really going to start to see that more often from Apple, because I think under the new leadership, it's like, well, if a feature is done and it's kind of standalone, let's just add it. Let's just release it, ship it.
Right, because you always have new things to announce anyway, so there's no reason why you would need to hold something like that back, because...
And this kind of helps the marketing in a way, because it's like, this way, there's something new all the time to talk about. There's always a new thing, like, oh hey, here's iOS 9.1, we've added iCloud Drive sharing, now you can share things with people and collaborate and do all these other things, and it ties into iWork, and now we've got iCloud Drive with iWork with full like annotations and this and that, and like they could do a whole update just on that and everyone would go nuts. Like, people would leave Google Docs, people would leave Office, well, maybe, but it would be good enough that people could just use it and not consider switching.
Well, I think that's, it's part of the expectation with people is that they have, you know, they expect massive sweeping changes in every OS release, and then they're very disappointed when that doesn't happen, right? So by doing this, by kind of trickling these larger features into smaller releases throughout the year, it kind of keeps people satiated, you know, throughout that period of time between these big releases. And then perhaps, you know, we'll get to a point in the future where people just completely forget about OS version numbers and they don't even think about it. It's not even at the forefront of their mind. It's just, you know, just as regular software updates, and they're just getting features all the time. And it seems like version numbers have been getting less and less important anyways, because you just look at how app developers do versions. Like, for example, great case in point is Facebook. For example, like version 24, and it's like every 2 weeks we update our app with bug fixes and performance improvements. It's completely mean. The release notes are meaningless.
Messenger's the one that's like 26. What's Facebook? Oh, Messenger's on 29.1.
Exactly. And you know, it's funny because I see nerds complain about
version
numbers. It's like, you know what? Nobody cares. Nobody looks at the version number. Nobody cares. Only you care. Only a very small subset of techs worry about that kind of thing. But the average person doesn't look at that stuff. My dad doesn't look at a Facebook version number. He doesn't even read the release notes.
No, I mean, version numbers are really just for internal version control. It's not really about, like, oh, this means this, this means that. Like, it means something for Apple. And it means something for major companies that release major software. But, like, if it's an app store app, does it really matter? It's like, here's an update, here's what we fixed, here's what we added. big deal, right?
Well, it used to be a selling point in the days of shareware software where you didn't have... This is just like way, way back before digital downloads or even before the internet became a thing. Remember, we had to do mail order software. So, you know, for example, software upgrades, we had paid upgrades, which has now been all but pretty much eliminated with the App Store models. And... you know, you would have to pay for an upgrade, and it really meant a big deal from a marketing perspective, for example, to go from 4.0 to 5.0. People expected a laundry list of changes because they were paying for something, and especially back in the days where, you know, average cost of a good piece of software was $100, you bet your ass it better be worthwhile. Otherwise, you know, you're not gonna fork over your hard-earned cash to that company. But yeah, those days are long gone.
Though, I mean, we do occasionally see, like, Tweetbot, for example. They had Tweetbot 2, then they had Tweetbot 3. Those are separate apps. So, I mean, it does happen, but very rarely, and only if there's a large enough fan base where it's like, okay, here's this brand new version. We've added like 600 things. The least you could do is spend $3.99 on the app again. We worked for literal months over this. Come on. And then everyone complains, why am I buying the app again? And we all die just a little inside.
We do, because they're holding a $700 phone, but they don't want to pay $3 for an app upgrade.
Yeah, or now a $700 phone and a $700 watch. Why do I have to pay $299 again? My stainless steel watch and you know, like, oh, those prices... Those are like whatever. That's necessary, but $2.99 for an app? How dare you, sir?
Why don't you forego your coffee budget for the following day and just buy the app upgrade?
I know. Like, we always get into this argument all the time. It just keeps happening, and it blows my mind. Like, why are people so willing to fork over hundreds and hundreds of dollars for an Apple product, but then they balk at $2 for an app that works on that product, that does something really useful?
It's frustrating to me, and I think it's definitely a stupid mindset, but I really feel like Apple created their own monster by creating this whole App Store model and really suggesting to developers, you know, that your app should be 99 cents. Like, this is what our target is. If you remember back when the App Store first rolled out after the, I think it was a year after the iPhone launch, right, 2008, they really stressed 99 cents for apps. So, you know, fast forward a few years and now that's the expectation. So you release a $3 app upgrade and, you know, people leave a one-star review and say, should have been free. Doesn't matter how good the app is, you'll never please people. I'm still shocked that there is no way for developers to reply to bad reviews. Why haven't they fixed that?
Yeah, I'm really unsure about that. That seems like something that should be part of iTunes Connect, really. Like, they've made a bunch of other improvements, but they haven't done that. And... people keep asking for paid upgrades, and I feel like there should be something there. Having nothing is obviously a negative. There should be a path to be like, here's this new version where we've changed X percent of the code and added this many features. Like, it should be something where Apple has to approve it. Like, okay, yes, you've added enough stuff.
It's worthy
of being a paid upgrade. Enough has changed. You've added enough stuff. This makes sense to charge people again. So we approve it. And then it's like, you either keep the version of the app you have, or you click buy, or no, not buy, upgrade. And there you go. That might get a little awkward, because then it's like you still have to have a support path for the old version, maybe.
And bundles are kind kind of a hack. I mean, I've seen people try to use that as a way of handling paid upgrades, but...
Then there's the other workaround, which is like, they release a free update, but then they hide the features behind an in-app purchase.
It's really terrible that people have to do this. I mean, this is very clear that developers want this feature.
Yeah, like all the time they have to do these workarounds. So it's like, just provide a really simple path to say, hey, here's something we really worked on hard. There's a lot of cool new stuff for you guys. It's going to make your lives easier. The least you can do is pay us $249 to get the new version.
And that's a really interesting point that you raised about being a review process for checking to see if that paid upgrade is actually worth being a paid upgrade. I think people would be willing to deal with that because right now they have nothing.
Yeah, and I mean, you kind of have to because then it's like... You would get people trying to game the system like every update is a paid update.
Exactly.
Like, ooh, hey, exactly. We fix this bug, pay us $5, right?
Well, especially a lot of those kind of scammy in-app purchase games, you do not want that stuff slipping by.
In fact, if I were Apple, I'd add a thing that's like, if your primary revenue source is in-app purchases, you are not allowed to do paid upgrades. Like, I would actually write that in to the terms and conditions. So, speaking of iOS, iPad. Wow.
I think this completely reinvigorated a lot of people's interest in the iPad that kind of forgot about it. I know a lot of people that sold their iPads or have iPads at least one or two generations old that have been sitting there not doing anything.
Yeah, I mean, I still have an iPad Air. I haven't bothered to upgrade or anything.
So. I'm still waiting for a 12-inch iPad Pro.
Ah, wow. That's all but certain at this point. Like, looking at those multitasking features, the first thing you think is, wouldn't it be great if I had a larger screen to do this on?
Well, not just that. Think about all the work Apple has been doing in auto layout stuff. And now, even this year, stressing even more, you need to be moving to the auto layout stuff. And Phil Schiller brought this up on the talk show with John Gruber, how, you know, they were preparing people for iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, even though they had not announced it. It was kind of a, you know, wink, nudge, nudge that, hey, you know, adaptive layouts are the future. You know, should we ever go down the path of offering larger devices? So it's now with auto layout, it totally makes sense. It's way easier for Apple to actually make a bigger screen iPad because you've got apps that just will look just as beautiful on a 12-inch iPad as they do on a 9.6-inch iPad.
Yeah. Like, this is what I always pay attention to. Like, in the sessions when somebody at Apple in a session says something like, you should really be looking at this, or you should really consider using this for your app, that's basically code for, we're totally going to use this exclusively either in the fall or next year. And if you don't put it in your app, you're going to be screwed.
It's so stupid because it's not like Apple doesn't do these things to make developers' lives more difficult. It should be very obvious. Like, if you're that thick and you don't get it, that something like auto layout is designed for, you know, for an ecosystem where you have the, you know, this portfolio of devices with different screen sizes, then you should stop making apps because it's very clear.
And then it's like, not only that, but then some of these devices, the app can be any width on that device because you can snap it to the side and then be like, oh, let's make it iPhone width. Oh, let's make it this width, and so on. So... even though the iPad Pro isn't out yet, the other shoe has effectively dropped in that if you're not building your iPad apps to these new size classes, if you're not using auto layout constraints, if you're not using these new stack views and such, then people are going to be trying to multitask with your app and they're going to complain big time. Because the layout is going to screw up, and then they'll all be upset.
Speaking of auto layout, to the layman in plain English, obviously this means that that apps will be able to adapt to different screen sizes. But what did they announce at WWDC in terms of improvements? Because I know that's been a struggling point for a lot of a lot of developers, and I heard that they made some significant headway, but I don't know the technical details about it. I haven't watched the session yet.
Yeah, I haven't looked at it yet, but the new stack view is designed to automatically restructure content. It's basically a whole view that's like, here's this collection of items, and then as the size of the window decreases, these items will automatically rearrange and scale to fit. So it's a lot like CSS Flexbox, where it's like, okay, everything inside the Flexbox, as the Flexbox shrinks, everything reflows to fill the space.
Right, so you don't have to programmatically figure out exactly how your app is going to change based on those other factors.
If on an iPad app you have this big list of cards that go left to right, top to bottom, you would want to consider refactoring that to use a stack view, because then on iOS 9, when people try multitasking with the app, those cards will automatically reflow as the app shrinks and expands. I'm not sure exactly if they improved auto layout in any way. I would assume that they have. I haven't really read up on everything yet. I've mainly been looking at things that are hints for future hardware.
Well, we should talk about some other stuff, I think, because there's so much stuff to talk about with WWDC.
Yeah, it's a huge info dump. E3.
Yes, so Oculus announced two separate products. Obviously, the Oculus Rift, which everyone knows already exists, but they went into a little bit more details about the finalized technical specification, as well as something called Oculus Touch, as well as some games that you'll be able to actually play in 2016 when these products are officially released. It's so easy to be snarky and comment about how ridiculous somebody looks with all this VR stuff. I know I fell prey to that when I saw a picture of somebody wearing the Oculus Rift headset plus the touch controllers. I'm like, dear God, this looks absurd. I'm sure the experience is actually good, though. There's no way getting around how silly this stuff will look, and it's going to continue to look, you know, silly. But it's not like you're going to be walking around with this stuff. You're doing it in the privacy of your own home, right? So it doesn't really matter how ridiculous the headset looks. Although from an industrial design perspective, I think it actually looks pretty slick considering the size. The size that it needs to be.
Yeah,
it actually
the final consumer version looks pretty good, and the integrated stereophonic headphones will be nice for total immersion.
It's interesting, you know, when I look back at the history of VR, and I'll put VR in air quotes because it wasn't really VR, and stuff like the Virtual Boy, stuff like that. I mean, the thing is, like, I look at this hardware, like the Oculus Rift, what it's currently capable of, and I just think this is what we wanted 25 to 30 years ago, but it wasn't available. And so people probably shouldn't have even attempted to build this stuff in the 80s, but here we are. So it looks like finally good VR is upon us. From what I've heard from people who have actually tried it, it's supposed to be pretty good. The sound apparently is quite good with that thing as well. But I'm interested in this Oculus Touch stuff. I haven't actually seen any demos yet, but it looks interesting. I think that's a really interesting aspect of just adding this extra layer of immersion to the product, because in addition to just having the headset, for example, I can see like things like being able to pick up objects in games. You would want to have some kind of haptic feedback happen, so that totally makes sense. And I think it makes sense to have the individual controllers, you know, one in each hand, as opposed to just having a traditional. See, I think if they tacked that stuff onto a traditional form factor, like the controllers we're currently using on game consoles, it wouldn't work. They needed to change the form factor, because this is really a completely new venture. It's a new experience.
Yeah. Then, of course, at the same time, they did announce that it will work with the Xbox One controller for certain games, like games that require joysticks and such, like Eve Valkyrie.
Well, and there's not entirely surprising, but a short list of games they've announced for it. But, this is one of those things where the hardware has to be released, and, you know, it's going to take a while to kind of pick up steam and get developers on board. But speaking of developers, it's interesting that they announced that they're going to offer some cash for developers as incentive to build games for the platform. So it should be interesting to see whether or not that's actually successful or not. Because I think Microsoft did something like that for Windows Phone, right? But I mean, just look at that ecosystem. Money does not necessarily equal people adopting your products and platform, but it remains to be seen.
The VR scene right now is going to be very fast-paced and very brutal. Like, I don't know that consumers really have a good option at this point, because a lot of products keep getting announced. Like, you've got Morpheus with Sony, and apparently they're going to be announcing stuff at E3. There was a leak just now that there is going to be a PlayStation Move 2 that works with Morpheus. And it looks a lot like Oculus Touch. Asymmetric controllers in each hand with triggers. Sound familiar? So they've got theirs. Oculus is working with Microsoft, so I guess Xbox One will probably work with Oculus in addition to Xbox One streaming to Oculus on a PC. Something like that. Like, Oculus is clearly Microsoft's answer to Sony's Morpheus. Probably. Then you've got the HTC Vive, which is being developed by Valve.
Do you remember when Valve actually made games?
Oh god, it was a beautiful time.
It just seems like
I wish they still did.
It's like they completely forgot about that.
Oh yes, Starbreeze has announced Star VR. It is a 5K virtual headset with a unique 210-degree horizontal field of view.
5K on a VR headset? That's nuts.
Yeah, with insane field of view.
That sounds really expensive.
Dual 5.5-inch quad HD panel architecture, one per eye, provides a realistic visual experience with a total panoramic definition of 5120 by 1440.
So you can now experience even stronger seizures.
And it has some sort of weird tracker thing. It's got a 360-degree sub-millimeter positional tracker using fiducial markers that you can place on additional objects. So it's using something like Valve's Lighthouse. Custom Fresnel-based optics. 130-degree vertical field of view, 210-degree horizontal field of view, real-time 6 degrees of freedom, IMU and optical sensor fusion for low-latency experience. Good God.
And who's making this?
Starbreeze, who is partnering with Lionsgate, Toshiba, and some game companies I have not heard of.
I haven't even heard of Starbreeze.
They are the guys that make... what is it? Payday. Payday 2 Syndicate. They're doing that new Walking Dead game that's based on Payday. Chronicles of Riddick. The Darkness.
Okay, so they have some titles that I've heard of.
Yeah, they have a good pedigree. They're making an insane VR headset for some reason. And they've created a VR experience using this headset for The Walking Dead that they'll have at E3.
I'm not going to go as far as to say that there's a major shift in the industry towards VR. Obviously, that's not the case. But it seems like we have, I mean, very clearly some heavyweight titles here that are very interested in the tech. I mean, you have obviously companies like Sony investing a lot of money and R&D in VR, so it should be really interesting to see where this goes in, you know, the next 5, 10 years or so and beyond. I kind of feel like VR is what the Apple Watch is now, a product that is new, that it's in its infancy, that people don't really understand, that people are skeptical of, that people think is just a toy and not incredibly useful. And you won't even realize how good it is until the product starts maturing 5, 10 years down the road, and, you know, once it's gotten to, you know, version 3 or version 4.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say 5, 10 years. I'd say like 2 or 3 years max. But yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. VR seems like a gimmick right now, but I think once people start trying this stuff out, once people start having these amazing experiences and seeing what it can do, then we're really going to get to a place where it's like, whoa, I need to have this.
Well, I think in the pricing area, I think if, let's say, you can get this tech down to the same price of a PS4, if you, as a consumer, I think that's fantastic, because you walk into a store, you wouldn't have to decide, you know, you wouldn't have to figure out, well, I'll just go get a PS4 because it's cheaper. It's like, I have a choice between a PS4 or a VR headset. They're both the same price, but they both have a completely different and unique experience. And I now have the choice, that, and it's, you don't have to second guess it anymore. But it may be a couple of years down the road before we get to that point.
Oh, interesting. The Rift also incorporates a high-quality internal microphone for social experiences. So it's going to have built-in chat. They could work that into games as well. You could actually walk around in a VR environment and talk to characters.
Sweet. Now I can look forward to 13-year-old boys telling me how terrible I am when I'm playing Call of Duty online.
Yeah, and then you just hack the console and summon a laser katana and dice them, you know, in 2096. No, probably not that late. I think I want to say 7 years from now, it'll probably be like the latest gen console. Like the latest gen console 7 years from now will be VR, pretty much. That'll just be how you play games at that point.
Right, and perhaps even get to the point where something like a VR headset would just be, it wouldn't be necessarily considered like a separate console, a separate component that's on par with the console. Perhaps it may get to the point where it is simply an accessory. Like what the PlayStation Move stuff is now, it's just something like, oh, I buy a console and, oh, I want that VR experience. I'll just pay an extra $100 and get that as an add-on.
Yeah, or even like that far down the road, it could just come with the console. Like no longer optional, just this is how the console works. And obviously with miniaturization, the headsets will get slimmer, they'll get lighter. Eventually, it'll basically be like a pair of glasses. But that's like probably 15 years down the road. I mean, they'll still be fairly bulky, but I would say by 7 years from now, it might be like ski goggles or something. Not too bad, but yeah.
And that means, just getting to that point too, I mean, it'd be really interesting because you would have to design a new generation of consoles that have that in mind. Like if you're going to bundle the VR headset in mind, it's no longer a separate thing. It's, you know, from the ground up, you have to design your consoles with that experience in mind. Those two things are, it basically becomes one harmonious gaming experience.
Yeah, exactly. Right down to even the console's UI. And I think Oculus has actually done a rather good job showing what that might look like with their Oculus Home software, which is what I think it's the first thing you see when you boot up Oculus. It's a 3D, 360-degree operating system, essentially, that lets you check out the games that you have that support Oculus. It's got a friend list. It's got like a home theater for VR movies and stuff. So they're already starting to play with this concept of having VR interfaces for software.
Oculus is owned by Facebook, is it not? It's interesting. I haven't really seen very many people complain about that.
Well, I think it's because Facebook has mostly kept hands off for now, and there really hasn't been a giant indication that Facebook has really meddled with Oculus at all. Like,
well, even from the branding, if you just visit their website, you can't really tell.
Yeah, you would never know.
You would never know. It's a standalone company.
So to me, I think mostly they're treating it the same way that they've treated Instagram. Instagram is still its own thing. Yes, it falls under the Facebook terms of service, but there's no Facebook branding visible. Your Instagram login is still your Instagram login. You can create an Instagram account by logging in with Facebook, but it's still separate. So yeah, I mean, it's very much its own company, even though they're owned by Facebook. And that, to me, is a sign that Facebook really believes in these companies enough to be like, look, you guys are awesome. We're going to let you do what you do best. Somewhere down the road, we think this could be useful for our stuff. I think it's basically like somewhere down the road, they would like Facebook to be like the social glue that holds Oculus systems together, where it's like, if you have this seamless metaverse of content and people go into VR to chat with people halfway across the world, like all the stuff that we've read in sci-fi books about VR, like if that happens, they want to be the login system for that. They want to be the friends list for that.
This is very long-term strategy then.
Oh yeah. This might not pay off for 15 years, but when, for lack of a better term, the metaverse goes live, they want to be there as the social part of it.
Replace metaverse with Skynet.
Yes, it traps us all in VR and kills us that way.
That sounds like a terrible plot for a movie.
Drooling and starving to death as we are forced to endure VR experiences.
You've watched Steins Gate, right?
I have. I haven't seen all of it yet, though.
Oh, okay. Well, I finished the series. Kind of looking forward to this visual novel game that's coming out for the Vita. I haven't read any reviews yet, but it looks interesting. If the story in the game is anywhere near as good as the story in the anime was, I'm totally going to buy that. And they announced, actually, yeah, there's like a limited edition version of the physical copy of the game for Vita that's going to come with some extra stuff, I think, here. Art book, t-shirt, and I thought the soundtrack, but it could be wrong. Are you a big visual novel type person?
I haven't really played a lot of them, I don't think.
Have you played Danganronpa 1 and 2?
Not yet. I've been meaning to. I haven't bought them yet.
My god, those games are amazing.
I know, I've heard. I'm going to.
Though I'm not particularly enthused about this newer one that's coming out, because it's not, it's like a completely different game.
Oh, the one that's kind of like a shooter, it looks like?
Yeah, it just doesn't look as interesting to me.
Speaking of games, Bethesda's press conference is tonight at 7.
Am I supposed to be excited?
Well, they're going to talk Fallout 4, and
I've never played the Fallout games.
More importantly, due to an accidental Twitch broadcast, they accidentally leaked that Dishonored 2 is going to be announced.
Should I know what that is?
Oh.
Sorry, I've never heard of it.
Okay, so Dishonored is a really cool steampunk game that was made by Arkane. It's set in an alternate universe where the Industrial Revolution takes place on the back of whale oil. So everything in this culture revolves around whaling. There are like whalebone charms and songs about whaling and all these various things.
Sounds terrible.
And it's very much a dystopian universe. There's like an empress, and like it's like this twisted dark version of the British Empire, basically. And there's magic. And you play this guy who was the bodyguard to the Empress, and the Empress is assassinated by these mysterious people, and you get blamed for the whole thing. And the game is basically you trying to figure out what happened and rescue the Empress's daughter, who is next in line as a result of the assassination. And you have to like assassinate some people or not, to kind of get through the story. So like you can play through and absolutely murder everyone, but that raises your chaos level and it changes the ending. Whereas you can sneak through, not kill anyone, and disappear your targets, send them to grisly fates that aren't death, but possibly worse. And that keeps your chaos low, and then you get the good ending. And you have a vast array of abilities to kind of get through the level and get to your target. Like, you can possess mice and sneak in through a sewer grate. You can possess guards and open locked doors that you wouldn't have been able to otherwise. You can teleport. So you can blink across rooftops, get in through the window, that sort of thing. And then when you're in there, you've got a sword and a pistol at your disposal. But obviously, if you're trying to do a non-lethal playthrough, those aren't going to be very helpful.
Sounds very peculiar, but somewhat intriguing.
It's a very cool game. The art direction was actually done by the guy that designed Half-Life 2. So if you think it looks a bit like City 17, that's because it was designed by the same guy.
And this is a game that's how old and available on what platform?
It's available on PC, Xbox 360, PS3. It came out, I think, 2 or 3 years ago.
I'm surprised I missed that.
3 years, actually. Came out October 9th, 2012.
And I don't think I had a PS3 back then.
It actually won Game of the Year. And then they had some subsequent DLC that added some story content. So it kind of went into 2013 in terms of story content.
We'll have to put a link in the show notes for that.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's going to be really cool. I'm not sure how the story is going to go after the ending of the first one, but I guess we'll find out.
So what's the deal with Fallout? I don't even know what that's about.
Okay. So in a nutshell, the Fallout universe is a universe where 50s Americana never died and the nuclear age never ended. Nuclear power kind of became everything. They had nuclear-powered cars, nuclear-powered robots, everything. And the tech advanced, but in kind of a 50s way. Like, they had Robbie the Robot robots and, like, weird laser guns that looked like zap guns from sci-fi, that sort of thing. And then eventually in 2090-something, World War III began between the United States, Russia, and China, and there was a nuclear apocalypse. But some people survived because the largest company in America, Vault Tech, created a number of vaults to keep people alive. Of course, the twist was a lot of these vaults were actually twisted science experiments. So, for example, there was a vault where there were 999 women and one man, or the opposite, or a vault that had a psychotropic drug released into the air, or a vault that was designed to never be opened and they put a crazy despot in charge, or one where they were told that they had to sacrifice somebody every year to stay alive.
That's pretty nutty.
Yeah. And there were, I forget exactly how many they made. I think it was like 111 vaults. And a few of them were control vaults where people were kept perfectly normal as a sample, like as a control for the experiment.
Who is the protagonist in that?
Every game has a different protagonist, but they always come from a vault. And usually the opening scene of the game... Well, I mean, the first like chunk of the game takes place in the vault, usually. And then the big major scene where you see the title and the title music plays is when you open the vault and venture out into the wasteland.
And what is the, without giving it away, what is the primary goal? Are you supposed to be overtaking a corporation, or what is it?
Every game has a different story. Usually there are several factions involved. For example, what was left of the U.S. military formed a group called the Brotherhood of Steel. And they kind of charged themselves with keeping the old technology alive and trying to bring it back. So, like, trying to bring back a semblance of society, that sort of thing. Some of them take this goal very seriously, almost fanatical, so they will kill people just to get their hands on old world tech, to keep it out of other people's hands. There's also a faction that's what was left of the U.S. government, the ones that basically orchestrated the Vault Tech experiments. They're referred to as the Enclave. Then there are bandits. There's another faction who follows a guy calling himself Caesar. They act like Roman soldiers. They keep slaves. It's horrible. Also very Mad Max-ish. So yeah, it's just kind of a really cool post-apocalyptic action series.
So my question to you is, should I play the most recent one?
New Vegas is pretty good. You would probably enjoy it, I would think. Obviously the graphics are a bit dated now. But yeah, it's definitely still playable.
Graphics have never stopped me from playing a game, considering that I own a Sega Genesis.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty standard first-person shooter. Well, I say that, but it isn't really. Like, at face value, it's a first-person shooter, but your stats actually count towards how well you do fighting people. So the higher your accuracy is, the higher your skill with a particular gun is, the more critical hits you'll get, that sort of thing. You'll miss less often. Your gun will break less often, that sort of thing. You can also run in survival mode where you have to eat and drink to stay alive. I don't usually play it on that mode, but, that can be interesting, especially because a lot of the stuff is irradiated, so that can add radiation to your radiation level, and that'll eventually make you sick and cause you to lose health. So, yeah, lots of little fun gameplay elements. And then if you don't want to do the whole first-person thing, there's actually a system called VATS, which kind of harks back to the series' infancy as a isometric turn-based shooter. So that was where you would like decide to attack this enemy with this thing, and then based on your stats, it would decide how well you did. Like, so-and-so hits this enemy for whatever damage kind of thing. That was the original two Fallout games. But then when Bethesda took over Fallout, they made it a first-person shooter, but then they added this VATS system. So you have a number of action points, and you can use those action points to slow time and target a particular part of an enemy to cripple them. So you can aim for their arm where they're holding the gun, and if you hit them successfully, it stuns them for a bit and makes them more likely to miss you when they try to fire at you. Or you can actually shoot the gun out of their hands. Or you can try for headshots to take them out quicker, that sort of thing.
Great. Well, I should probably give this game a try then.
Yeah, it's really fun. The quests are incredibly amusing. There's a lot of pop culture references throughout the games, which is not likely to stop in the fourth one. And the fourth one takes place in Boston, so we can all look forward to the accents. I parked my car in the bomb. There's a nuclear bomb over there.
I am no expert on Boston accents, so I'm not even going to comment on that.
Yeah, I know. Everyone from Boston probably wants to kill me right now. Sorry, guys. Sorry. But yeah, it should be interesting to see how, like, Boston they go. Like, it would almost be bad if you start playing Fallout 4 and then nobody has a Boston accent. It's like, I'm in Boston. Why is everyone talking like this? We'll see. They should actually be showing full gameplay for Fallout 4 tonight, so.
Is that thing live? Will it be streamed live? Where do we go see this?
I think it's live, yeah. It'll be on Twitch, I think, on their E3 coverage. So you'll just have to go to Twitch, and then see what there is to see. Yeah. Tune in tonight at 6:45 p.m. Yeah. So they're streaming it on Twitch. So if you just go to Twitch, search for Bethesda, I guess, then you should be able to grab a link to their E3 stream. And that's tonight, or will have been tonight when you listen to this. So yeah, should be interesting.
Anything else that came up in the week that you want to talk about, or should we wrap?
Yeah, I'm kind of drawing a blank. Apart from, like, these 2 weeks are basically like WWDC NE3. It's nerd Christmas. It's the nerd holiday season. Games and Apple stuff. What else is there?
And on that note,
thank you for listening, everyone. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Impromptu. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to leave a rating on iTunes and let your friends know about us. Detailed show notes for each episode are available on our website at theimpromptu.net. You can follow the show on Twitter at The Impromptu, as well as our hosts individually at Zen Impulse for Michael Norton and at Zero Distraction for Alex Knight. As we are entirely listener supported, you can donate to us at theimpromptu.net/donate. All proceeds go towards covering bandwidth as well as equipment upgrades to uphold the highest level of audio quality you've come to expect. We really do appreciate your support, and we look forward to seeing you next time.